you're putting me in a hell of a position here, but I have no choice. You're not going to kill Santa Claus because he doesn't exist.
Really, Brian? He doesn't exist?
That's right. He's not real.
Oh, interesting. Interesting theory, Brian. Who else isn't real? You going to tell me that Elmo isn't real? Huh? SpongeBob? Is he not real, Brian? Is SpongeBob not there at the bottom of the ocean giving Squidward the business? And what about Curious George? Huh? Does he not really exist? Is Curious George not really out there making little boats out of newspapers that he should be delivering? Huh? Educate yourself, you fool.
It's the Banal of America Audio Holiday Special featuring Stanton Friedman.
Happy holidays!
It's the one night of the year when we all act a little nicer, we smile a little easier, we share a little more. For a couple of hours out of the whole year, we are the people that we always hoped we would be. Have a Merry Christmas, everybody.
William Cherry wants to know your thoughts on John Keel.
I met John. I heard him speak. I thought that he went well beyond his data over and over again. At one point, he said the MJ-12 documents were phony because they weren't done on 8x10 paper. That was all they used at that time, he said. Well, I have been to 20 archives, and I'll guarantee you there was plenty of 8.5x11 paper being used. He had Goddard doing his work near Azteco. Well, it was 300 miles from there, near Roswell, New Mexico. So, John, I don't feel got his facts straight much of the time.
Right.
And so I'm not a booster.
There you go. Okay. Mike Church wants to know, and I'm interested in this too because I'm trying to follow it, but it's tricky. He wants to know your thoughts on the EM drive and how, while it apparently works, it defies relativity, and he wants to know what you think that might mean for space exploration. What do you know about this EM drive that people are
talking
about?
Well, that term, electromagnetic, has been used with reference to several different kinds of drives. And, for example, I have been saying, well, since at least 1968, when in my congressional testimony, that between the stars, I want nuclear fusion and or fission, maybe both. But when you're in a planetary atmosphere where the conditions are altogether different than they are in the empty space between stars, mm-hmm. where you've got an atmosphere, you've got pressure, you've got temperature considerations, weather, and all kinds of stuff. And remember that we do have plenty of reports of huge motherships which have small, what I call Earth extension modules. The analogy here would be like the nuclear-powered aircraft carrier that I mentioned, which can operate for 18 years without refueling. It carries 75 little airplanes that can fly for, 2 hours without refueling?
Right, right.
So my solution for between the stars is nuclear fusion. But within the atmosphere, and the ones that crash are not the motherships, incidentally. They're this much smaller Earth excursion module.
Yeah, maybe they would be able to cover up a mothership crash.
Hardly. I think that that's where we have an EM drive. I have postulated, because I've done some work on, for example, the EM submarine. That works by having electric and magnetic fields produced in an electrically conducting fluid, seawater. That salt water is a good conductor of electricity. And Westinghouse scientist Dr. Stuart Way actually operated a small, with a bunch of students from the University of California, Santa Barbara, an electromagnetic submarine. No moving parts. It was neat. And then the Japanese, Kawashima, I think, also operated one, and they even used superconducting magnets.
Now, I believe Mike is talking about this specific, EM drive that's been in the news over the last, 6 months. Do you know about this thing?
Well, I've only heard comments that implied that, oh, this is the secret to it. What we got to do is use electromagnetic systems to kick particles out the back end. And what I'm saying is, I don't know how that's going to work out within the atmosphere, but I do know that if you ionize the air, and interact with making electrically conducting fluid. You know, when the Apollo comes back, you got this glow around it.
Right.
Because it's really going fast, 25,000 miles an hour. Well, okay, if you have a plasma around a craft in the atmosphere as an electrically conducting fluid, you can control lift, drag, heating, sonic boom production, radar profile. Those are nice things to be able to control. And you could make right-angle turns because you can exert high and low electromagnetic forces in very short periods of time. So I would call that an EM drive, a plasma drive within the atmosphere. People have talked about using plasmas outside the atmosphere. You kick electrically conducting fluid out the back end of a rocket. But I like the plasma thing because it helps explain some of the things. Well, I'll give you an example. Talking to a guy who was at a Nike missile site many years ago, and they have radar, you know, to detect incoming Russian missiles, supposedly. And they pick up something on the radar, and he's outside, and he's talking to them, and he's seeing it. It changes color, and it goes off the radar. And that would make sense if you've got an electrically conducting fluid around the craft. You pick up the guy's radar signal and you say, oh, we got to change the characteristics of that plasma so it becomes totally absorbing to that particular frequency. Well, I had a second story in Texas, a military group, radar group. They pick up the UFO and suddenly it's off. It's not on the screen anymore. And the boss comes in and says, hey, change frequency. They change frequency and there it is again. So it makes sense that you sense what the other guy is sending your way and you adjust the properties of your cloak, if you will. This is a good way to say cloaking, you know.
Yeah.
And so I consider that part of an electromagnetic drive. And the submarine did work. You know, we haven't built any because Stuart didn't want to get involved in military stuff. And it would have cost a lot of money to develop it and so forth and so on.
Yeah.
But, you know, so there are a lot of things going on that are different, if you will. And that's what you got to look for.
Okay. Marco Withrow, he says he saw an interview with you many years ago where you said in the beginning of your interest in the subject, you've said this many times on this show, that you read a few books but you weren't convinced. Then you read more books and you still weren't convinced. He wants to know, what was the one thing that pushed you towards the ETH rather than some other explanation? He thinks it may have been the Hill case, but I think it was Project Blue Book Special Report 14, right?
Special Report 14 was the thing that really shocked me. I'd read all these books, and I was kind of, oh, I don't know what's going on here. And then I found that at the University of California, Berkeley Library. And it was surprising on a couple of grounds. One, I'd already read 10 books, and none of them had mentioned it. And two, I found tables, graphs, charts, data. I'm a data hound. And quality evaluations and cross comparisons between unknowns and knowns. And I also found, and this shocked me, that the Secretary of the Air Force lied through his teeth at the press release that went out. So that was two things together, all kinds of data that I hadn't known existed and none of the books mentioned. And secondly, clearly intentional lying by the Secretary of the Air Force. He said, on the basis of this report, we believe that no objects such as those popularly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available. Well, the fact is the unknowns were 21.5%, not 3%, and they were completely separate from the category listed as insufficient information. By definition, that really made me angry to be lied to by the Secretary of the Air Force. So that was the thing that pushed me off the teeter-totter. I knew where I was going now.
You know, there you go. Yeah.
So that was it. I didn't see a saucer. Nobody I knew very well had seen a saucer.
Did we ever get to the bottom? I know I asked you a few years ago, but did we ever find out what happened with Project Blue Book 13 that apparently we don't know?
No, I've heard there are different explanations. I love the one that says, well, you know, it's like some buildings don't have a 13th floor. They were superstitious. Well, that's absolute nonsense as far as I'm concerned. I worked on a program where I put out two final reports. One was unclassified and one was very highly classified, and I don't even have a copy myself. So it would be perfectly natural for 13 to have the good stuff.
Right.
And remember that General Bolander's comment about reports which could affect national security are not part of the Blue Book system. And I think they were part of Majestic 12, and they ain't telling us anything about Majestic 12.
Right.
You may have noticed. And if people say, oh, that was a bunch of nonsense, read my book, Top Secret Magic, M-A-J-I-C.
There you go. Okay, so we still
I hope to convince you.
That's a fantastic book, folks. I love all the books, and I'm looking forward to checking out Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers. Wayne Nunn, he wants to know your opinion on the ancient astronaut theory. That's very popular. It's grown very popular in the last, you know, few years.
Yeah. Well, I think as soon as you say, hey, it doesn't take very long to go from being primitive to having H-bombs, you know, look back 120 years and say how the world has changed. And when you figure the planet's been around for over 4 billion years and the universe for 13 billion years, it would astonish me if we were the most advanced civilization. You know, because it didn't take that long to go from the caveman to the H-bomb.
Right.
So I think others, because we know that there are stars older than the sun, and we know that, therefore, there are planets much older than Earth, that if life, you know, even if it only started a few places and they colonized other places and they colonized other places. So I think that it would be astonishing if there weren't advanced civilization checking us out 1,000, 10,000 years ago. You'd want to keep tabs on the neighborhood because you want to know when they reach that fusion point.
Right.
You know, because then they are a threat to off-Earth civilizations. And I presume that it's the duty of every planetary government to be wary of threats from others who have H-bombs.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, they're going to say, we don't care what's going on out there, because they all would know that once you realize that fusion exists, that you could use it for propulsion. So maybe it takes you 60 years. Big deal. Or 100 years. That's nothing.
Right. And also, Wayne, I'll throw it. I don't like people that send two questions, but I will because I like this one. He wants to know what you think of Walter Bosley's work regarding the Sonora Aero Club. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Walter's stuff. Or do you know about the Sonora Aero Club? Aero Club.
Wasn't that the 1897 stuff?
Yeah. Have you put much thought into that?
Well, I did some looking at it, and it was clear that there were people thinking about flight back then. That was before the Wright brothers. But so I'll put that in my gray basket.
There you go.
I don't know what to think about them. Maybe. I don't say that, oh, clearly that was alien. I'm not saying that at all.
Yeah, how would anyone, yeah.
Big jump.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, let me see. Gracie Jane Gollinger. This is an incredibly specific question. I'm wondering if you'll I'll be thrilled if this resonates with you, but we'll see. Gracie seems to recall that you had a long career in the nuclear energy business. Obviously, we've talked about that.
Yes.
For 12 years. Could you discuss
14.
No, 12. Well, yeah, you and I have. Yes, absolutely.
Right.
Could you discuss what you know about the Westinghouse Waltz Mill site near New Stanton, PA, which she presumes is a coincidental name, New Stanton, PA, specifically the nuclear research and subsequent mishandling of nuclear materials therein? This is at the Westinghouse Waltz Mill near New Stanton,
well,
PA.
Well, yeah, when I worked on the nuclear rocket engine, this would be from 1966 through 68. Headquarters technically was Waltz Mills, yes. And I don't think we mishandled anything. You know, we didn't get support to build the actual, to to build a working system besides the original test vehicle, the NRX-A6. We didn't test it at Westinghouse, though. We tested it out at the nuclear test site in Nevada, right near where they test atom bombs, not far from Area 51.
Right.
I worked, Walt Mills was the headquarters for Westinghouse Astronuclear Lab. And remember, Pittsburgh had a lot of different Westinghouse divisions there in Yon. Some had to do with submarines. We didn't. And aircraft carriers, nuclear-powered, and nuclear power reactors. Westinghouse is one of the major manufacturers of them. So I don't think our group didn't mishandle anything.
Yeah. Well, that she, in addition, sort of the little add-on to that, I don't know where she's getting the subsequent mishandling of nuclear materials. So maybe that happened after you guys left town. But she wants to know if you think there's any connection between the Waltz Mill and any paranormal activity that's happened around Westmoreland County. It's a sort of this whole separate idea, I think, in a way, where it's like the visitors, let's say, have an interest in the nuclear aspect of things, which seems to be the case.
Well, I don't deny that there are many examples. Look at Robert Hastings' work, for example.
Right, exactly. That's what I was alluding to.
And Mr. Salas with the nuclear tip missiles and stuff. I don't see any connection between paranormal and nuclear, other than a lot of people don't understand both of them.
I like that. All right. Kirk Walker wants to know if you think the Cash Landrum UFO could have been an experimental nuclear aircraft.
No.
Very nuclear evening tonight.
Well, they don't often get a chance to talk to some nuclear physicist who's crazy enough to look at the paranormal.
Exactly. There you go. So you don't think that was, you said no? I kind of talked over you there.
It was one of my first thoughts when I heard about the case. I talked to John Schussler about it. He's a good, solid engineer from McDonnell Douglas. And just in going over the case, it is an idea that suggests itself because of the radiation damage to the Cash and Landrum, well, and the grandson, but Colby. I don't think it was, I presume the question has to do with whether it was our nuclear-powered craft.
I think that's the implication, yeah. Yeah, he says experimental, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think so. They may have. Look, it wouldn't be surprising if they were using nuclear energy. It's a great way to put a lot of energy in a small space. We've already gone over that. You know, when a bomb gives you 16,000 tons of dynamite energy release instead of 10, that's kind of neat, isn't it? You know, so it wouldn't be surprising. But I don't. Never did feel that there was a connection there.
Okay. Let's see. We're heading towards the home stretch here. So, all right. Carl DeMarco would like to know what your favorite scenario would be for Joe Nichols and Michael Shermer, who are modern skeptics, to finally have to admit the existence of UFOs. And would it involve any probes?
Probes of them?
Yes, like maybe they'll get abducted. I'll go to the the nicest route.
Yeah. Look, I debated Michael Shermer on Coast to Coast Radio, and I won the debate 80% for me, 20% for him. He didn't know a damn thing about flying saucers. He had a lot of notions that he came up with, but nothing to do with the facts, the data, the solid information. Now, Joe Nichol, some of his explanations for cases are just outrageous. What do you expect from a professor of English? Which is what he was. He wasn't a scientist. I should say is, as far as I know, he's still alive.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't call him a skeptic. I'd call him a debunker. There's a difference. The skeptic says, I don't know.
Exactly.
The debunker says, I do know. Ain't nothing to that, man.
Right.
There's a difference in attitude. The four rules for debunkers. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. What the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. You never hear any of these guys talk about Blue Book Special Report 14. The third rule is that if you can't attack the data at all, it's easier. Nobody will know the difference anyway. And fourth, do your research by proclamation. Investigation is too much trouble, and nobody will know the difference. So debunkers have a code of, I'll put quotation marks around, ethics.
Yeah, yeah.
Behave unethically, because that's what matters. You can get your point across easier that way if you don't let the facts get in the way.
Exactly, exactly. Hey, folks, I read you a quote there earlier from a contemporary of Joe Nichols and Michael Shermer, or someone who fancies themselves a contemporary, and you saw how completely off base and wrong that was about UFOs.
Yes.
And fake news. It's like if and like Stan says, spoken from a place of proclamation, where you and me and the listeners, we know that's complete malarkey, and so it's just.
Yes.
It's maddening. I salute your patience over all these years, because anytime I saw that little quote today and it was sticking in my craw all day, and I can't imagine how you've had to put up with these clowns for all these years.
Let me make a point about that. People think I must get a hard time from my audiences. I don't. I've given over 700 lectures, 50 states, 10 provinces, 19 other countries. I was in Bulgaria not long ago, a hotbed of ufology.
Nice, Bulgaria.
I've been in Hungary, too, you know. Hungary, is that a country? No, I don't think so. But my point is, I am not a masochist. I don't do this. I've had 11 hecklers, two of whom were drunk, in more than 700 lectures all over the place. And many of these are professional groups, mostly college audiences, but sections of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, engineering societies, hither, thither, and yon. And I don't get a hard time from people. They listen to the facts. They admit that they hadn't read this or that report. I'm a little sneaky. I ask them after I talk about 5 large-scale scientific studies, how many of you have read this? But let me give you results of a little experiment that happened in a class on campus with the professor's cooperation. I wanted to ask the question of the class, 2 questions, but I wanted them to vote with their eyes closed, and he would count the votes. Not me, he would. 2 questions. How many of you think most people don't believe in flying saucers? And how many of you do believe that some flying saucers are alien spacecraft? Amazingly, it was 80% yes for both.
Interesting.
So most people believe in flying saucers. They believe that most other people don't. So it's not surprising that I don't get a hard time from my audiences, because I present facts and data and solid information. And so where's the problem? You know, I'm a scientist. I present information, not misinformation, which the debunkers present all the time.
Yeah.
That's why I win debates. You know, I won the debate with Seth Shostak. I got 57% of the vote. He got 33%, and 10% said, oh, I don't know. He hadn't looked at any of the large-scale scientific studies. And if you haven't, you're not entitled to say you have a scientific opinion.
There you go. Bernie Mooney, we kind of already covered this question, but I like Bernie. He's a good friend, so we'll sort of like get it out there. He says, if UFOs are nuts and bolts crafts, why do you think after 60-plus years they keep playing cat and mouse and just don't land and introduce themselves? I mean,
well, I don't think we're worth talking to, and we don't know that they haven't landed and introduced themselves. There's a good story that Art Campbell has looked at about Ike supposedly playing golf in Atlanta, and his plane took him, while he was supposedly playing golf, to Alamogordo, New Mexico, at Holloman Air Force Base, and they parked at one side of the field, and there was a UFO at the other side, and they got together. And Art does some pretty good research. He's talked to more than one crew member of that plane. So they may very well have. But they recognize that things aren't going to change here just because they're coming here.
Right.
They're here for their purposes, I think. It's like how they interfere with nuclear tip missiles. They're not trying to help us in that sense. Hey, guys, we'll show you how to do these things right. There are probably rules about that. I really think there is a galactic federation, and I think as any sensible body of beings with minds, there are rules of behavior. And we certainly haven't demonstrated that we're willing to tolerate other people's behavior very much.
Exactly. All right, we're down to the final three here. Red Pill Junkie, who's a fantastic writer and thinker online. I don't know if you've met him yet, but he's a great guy. He asks, where do you think the best place in the solar system would be to look for organic life? Beside Earth, obviously.
Well, I'd give a shot at Mars, but I think there are probably... I'll call it alien societies that might have other bases in the solar system. I don't know where they are. I don't have a good way to look.
Mm.
So I don't know.
Just to piggyback on that thing, what do you think of this Proxima B discovery? Because isn't that right in the wheelhouse of the star map?
Well,
ish.
Not really.
Okay.
No, I like Zeta Reticuli better.
I thought it was in Zeta Reticuli. I was under the impression it was... in one of the two. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm sorry.
Reticuli is a southern sky star.
All right. I'll Google it while you answer the next question, and I'll get you the did you hear? Did you read the news about this Proxima B planet they found?
I've read it. Is that the one that is not too different in size and around the star from the Earth and not... where its star is not too different from the sun.
Right, right. It's like a super Earth. It's a very Earth-like planet that they're very. It's like
well,
the
yeah, a couple
they've
times
found.
Heavier and so forth.
Yeah, it's an Alpha Centauri.
Look,
I'm sorry. Yeah. So it's
I thought so, and that's different.
Okay.
But we don't know unless you have information on, say, a couple of dozen particular solar systems. Our notions about what it takes for life to establish itself someplace, they may come from another place and colonize and create conditions. I mean, look at Las Vegas. There was no way living there 100 years ago, was there? Or Los Angeles 400 years ago.
Right.
You know, thinking beings can establish suitable places for residence with a little effort. We do it all the time.
Mm.
I mean, think about it. The pilgrims, did they come to a city? No, they had help from the natives. You know?
Exactly, yeah, that's true. Curtis Scarrow wants to know your knowledge or views of current quantum physics, Moore's Law, and simulation theory. Jeez, Curtis, I mean, come on. Do you have any,
well,
thoughts?
The only
have any
one...
thoughts on those things?
Yeah, about Moore's Law, I do have a thought. Moore was ahead of a big... company that was crucial in the microelectronics business. And he decided in the mid-60s, after checking things out, that, holy cow, it looks like the number of transistors you can fit on a chip, microchip, was doubling every year or two, which doesn't sound like much, but if you do that 10 times, wow. And that's gone on for more than 40 years. And some people are thinking it's leveling off now. But my basic view is that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. You have to change how you do things.
Right.
You know, lasers aren't just better light bulbs. So, yeah, they produce light, but different technology. So I think Moore's Law has been a guiding light for a lot of people, recognizing that we're going to find out things that we don't yet know, and we'll get smarter,
yeah.
more technologically advanced, if you will. And I don't talk about quantum physics. That's not my bag.
All right. Red Sun Superman is the final question of the night. Red Sun Superman, who just had his gallbladder removed, so get well soon, Red Sun.
Ooh.
Superman. Yeah. He'd like to know how many astronauts you've had conversations with, assuming that you've spoken to some over the years.
I've spoken to several, Gordon Cooper and Bill Anders, and the second man to walk on the moon. We did a couple of television shows, as a matter of fact. And I have great admiration for the astronauts. And it was very interesting to me. I knew Bill Anders before he became an astronaut. He was working on nuclear systems for space.
Oh, wow.
And we were both chairing sessions at a meeting of the American Nuclear Society in the late 60s. And we got to talking, and we talked for a couple hours just about UFOs. And he bought copies. I was going to be giving a lecture. I was still working for Westinghouse. I was giving a lecture on the way home. And he bought copies of everything I had with me. But when I asked him, I understand that there have been sightings by astronauts that couldn't be explained. And the way he answered was something to the effect that, well, I don't think there were any sightings that couldn't be explained. But he said it in such a way that I felt I was touching on classified matters and I didn't have a need to know for them. And you don't intrude in those situations.
Right, right.
I respect other people's security clearances,
yeah,
and I wouldn't
yeah.
have told him stuff that was classified, you know, that he didn't have a need to know for. So I thought he was being very cautious. Now, he was on that mission, Anders, Borman, and Lovell, that went around the moon but didn't land.
Mm.
So he later became a real wheel in General Dynamics, I think it was. I have the greatest respect for the astronauts. They're the best of the best.
Yeah.
You know, and so I've been impressed. I've never indicated that they were giving me a hard time about flying saucers. They were cautious in what they said, but I expect that.
Yeah, exactly.
So they have my respect.
And, I mean, I'm sure some of them said some snarky things at times, you know, maybe to the media, I was assuming, just because of the way
sure.
things are. But it's like they never pulled the kind of stunts that these skeptics and the debunkers do. You know what I mean?
No.
They didn't, you know, they didn't make things up
no.
or you know, personally attack people and stuff. So that
no.
should tell people a lot. Well, folks, this is like, I'm telling you, this is a magical episode every year because we just did all of the questions and we came in right at the 90 minutes. So
you have talent, man.
Dude, it's all you, man. 12 years. We got a rhythm going. We're going to have to do it again next year.
I'll look forward to it.
Absolutely. Now, the new book is Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers, The Truth Behind the Misinformation, Distortion, and Derision by Debunkers, Government Agencies, and Conspiracy Con Men. I love it. I love the title. And you can get it at Amazon and whatever bookstores remain out there. Folks.
Or
still,
from me directly. Go to my website. www.stantonfriedman.com. And I autograph everything I send out. And the books by Kathleen Martin and myself, we have three of them. They're all signed by both of us.
Nice. All right. Well, folks, go over and get those if you can. And if you haven't got them already, definitely go and get them. I'm going to be picking the new one up very, very soon. And what do you have on tap for 2017? I know you
well,
obviously Roswell, the big Roswell 70th, and I'm going to try and get out
the
there
big,
this time for it. So.
Yes, it is the big Roswell 70th. Also, I'll be at the International UFO Congress in February.
Oh, nice.
In Phoenix. I'll be, for the first time ever, in Eureka Springs, Arkansas at the big conference. This is the first time they've invited me. What can I say? I'll also be speaking in Mexico, Puebla, outside Mexico City. And I'll be putting on my website a list of all the places I'm
going
to be speaking.
Any exotic, you said you were in Bulgaria. Any new exotic locations on the horizon?
No. Wouldn't it be nice to speak in No, it wouldn't be nice to speak in Antarctica because there's nobody there to listen.
Have you ever been to Iceland? That would be a good place for you.
No, I haven't been to Iceland. I've spoken in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And in Turkey.
Let's just jump to this just quickly before I let you go because I love hearing sort of the personal part of this. What was it like going to Bulgaria? What was that experience? I mean, because I haven't been to the moon, Mars, and I probably won't be making it to Bulgaria either, folks. So,
I was in Sofia, which is a big city, and the sponsoring organ, the guy was a professor and member of the Bulgarian Academy of Sciences.
Wow.
And there were several good papers by PhDs there. They translated, so I can say they were good papers. I heard the translation of them. And they translated me to Bulgarian. And it was interesting. It wasn't a huge crowd because apparently he got a grant to set this up. Would you
believe?
Nice.
Yeah.
So
wow.
It Look, Bulgaria, like every place else, people are interested in flying saucers.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, they joke like how the, you know, culturally things shift to different, you know, like how some places, I hate to use the expression, this, so like behind the times, you know what I mean? How like,
yeah,
David Hasselhoff's huge in Germany or whatever. It's like there's places around the world where they're just starting to kind of get into this stuff where we were like 20, 30 years ago. So, you know.
I was well received there and I haven't had a problem anywhere, you know. Even Saudi Arabia, a nice Jewish boy in Saudi Arabia. Not a bit of a problem.
There you go. And the Roswell 70th, of course, do you expect, you know, there's going to be a, and you're going to be slammed, I'm sure, with media, you know, you're going to be all over the place. Do you expect anything, is it just going to be a sort of another, you know, revisiting and file footage and stock footage thing? Is it, you think we're going to get anything out of this year? Is there going to be any news?
I don't know. I was surprised when I was there for the 50th anniversary, that there were over 300 journalists there.
Mm.
So I certainly expect that this is going to be very well attended. And I don't expect any breakthroughs, but how do you expect, by definition, you know, a breakthrough is something you don't expect.
Exactly. Yeah, that's
something
true.
Different. So I'm looking forward to it. They like me in Roswell. I like them.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, I do. Roswell is a town, the museum has been, it's one of the biggest tourist attractions in New Mexico. And that's despite the fact that when they started off, there were people who said, you want us to be the UFO cap crazy? Well,
singing a different tune now.
Certainly,
yeah.
They are.
Well,
and
they haven't
given
you the
key. People come there with their
city.
Families.
If they haven't given you the key to that city, then
they need
to build a statue to Stan Friedman in Roswell. Can we all agree on that? I think
in the Roswell UFO Hall of Fame.
Well, hey, I've said it before on the show. You need your own wing at this rate. So
okay.
Well, listen, I can't thank you enough. I had a blast. I haven't done a lot of shows this year, and doing this show lights the fire inside of me again that I need to be doing more programs.
Good.
So I had so much fun talking to you again, Stan, and it's been great.
It's my pleasure, Tim. I really enjoyed dealing with you because you're so knowledgeable. Not everybody who interviews me is very knowledgeable. So thank you.
That means a lot, man. Thanks a lot. Well, have a happy holidays. And
you too.
I hope all the listeners do as well. And hopefully I'll see you in Roswell. If not, I'll see you somewhere else down the line.
Okay.
In 2017. Thank you very much. Good night.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, there you go, folks. That was Stan Friedman, the 12th annual BOA Audio Holiday Special. Just unbelievable. I had so much fun tonight. That was awesome. Just great. Like I said to Stan just now, I haven't done too many shows this year, as I'm sure all of you know, but I was really loving that. I was loving that conversation and loving all those different roads we went down. So who knows? Well, I know we'll be doing another show in the next couple of weeks. I know that because we got one more traditional, I guess you could call it a holiday, one more traditional episode coming up in a couple of weeks. That's the annual autopsy of the year with Greg Bishop, where we dissect the year and what a year it's been, 2016. So I tried to stay as far away from politics as I could with Stan tonight because people are tired of that, and we didn't want to sully the holiday special with that. But we'll definitely be getting into that sort of topics on the 2016 year in review with Greg Bishop in a couple of weeks. I can't tell you when it'll be, but I talk to Greg Bishop probably 2-3 times a week nowadays, so we'll figure out when we can do it, and I'm sure it's going to be a real barn burner. And, you know, we'll talk about all the crazy stuff that's happened in the past year and where things are going. I've had my finger on the pulse of paranormal news more than I ever have in my entire life this past year. So I'll have a lot to say, and I'm sure Greg will as well. So stay tuned to Banal of America, and especially Banal of America on Facebook, because sometimes I post the news there rather than on the website. Sometimes it takes me a couple days, you know. So next thing you know, like tonight, I didn't post the news about this show going live until like 20 minutes before the show went live. I don't know what good that does anybody out there, but that's just sort of the nature of the beast. It's been an absolutely crazy year, and We'll have the year in review next week, or not next week, within the next couple of weeks. Who knows? Hopefully by you know, within the first, like, 5 days of 2017. Or if not then, yeah, I'd say that's probably pretty accurate, yeah. Maybe the second, I'm thinking. That kind of could be nice, but I got to talk to Greg. Let me see. Let me run down the list of folks who submitted questions so we can make sure to thank them. Tim, Lobo, David, Steve, Ron, Paula, Sean, Steve, William, Mike, Marco, Wayne, Gracie, Kirk, Carl, Bernie, Pill Junkie, Curtis, and Red Sun Superman. Thank you to everybody who submitted questions on the program tonight. I really do appreciate it. Fascinating questions. I don't even have time to do a show in general, so I shouldn't even say things like this, but I would love to someday sit down and collect all of these questions that we've posed to Stan over the years and put them together in something so people could get their hands on this, because we've got to have presented him with over 100 questions at this point in the last 12 years on just about every possible subject. I think if I did have it in my hands right now, I could probably turn to a page and tell you what Stan Friedman says about Bigfoot, because I'm sure we've asked him about it here on the show. So, yeah, I would love to do that. But as I said, I barely have time to do my own show. And I want to address a lot of that, I guess, on the year in review, because we'll close out what has been a very weird, tumultuous year here for Banal of America Audio 2016. And I'm really hoping that we can make a real fresh start at things in 2017 as we kick off what I announced on the Steve Bassett episode will be the final season of Banal of America Audio coming in January 2017. BOA Audio Season 10, we're going to say goodbye to the seasonal format. We've kind of, I don't even know, I wouldn't even say outgrown it at this point. It's like an old pair of pants that our ankles are sticking out. That's how long in the tooth the seasonal format has become. I mean, look at this. We're doing the 12th annual holiday special, and at the same time, we're getting ready to do Season 10. That's how crazy this is. Some of these seasons stretch over years at a time, and that doesn't really jive with me. It drives me crazy. I have like OCD about these things. So we're going to wrap it up on a nice bow with Season 10, and then who knows what's going to happen. Maybe I'll sit down and put together that book of Stan Friedman questions. Maybe I'll write a different book. I got a bunch of book ideas I've been wanting to do, but I never had the time, and now I have time. But I want to wrap up Season 10 first and then see what happens. And for the folks who are like, oh, no, you're not going to do a show anymore, believe me, I'm not going anywhere. We're going to reinvent and shed the seasonal format, maybe even shed the name. Who knows? We're going to do something different, because it's time to do something different. But before we can do anything different, we have to close the book on the BOA Audio adventure that has been going on for the last 12 years now, 10 seasons. Unbelievable. So that's going to be in January, but first, in a couple of weeks, the incomparable marathon man, Greg Bishop, will be on the show for his easily record-breaking umpteenth appearance on the program to wrap up 2016, to grouch about things. I'm sure him and I will have a mutual grouch session, which is always fun, and absolutely positively piss someone off. So you have that to look forward to as well. That'll be in a couple of weeks. Like I said, stay tuned. It'll be live. I'll try and announce it closer to when we actually have it all set up. And I guess that's it. So with that said, thank you so much, folks, for joining us here on the 12th annual BOA Audio Holiday Special. I got a little choked up at the end. Stan, he's just absolutely amazing, and I hold him in such high regard, and I was just blown away by his kind words there at the end of the show. He's the man, folks. I really do. I love the guy to death. I think he's the greatest UFO researcher that ever lived, the greatest UFO advocate, because that's really what this is all about, trying to advocate for people to look at this crazy subject, and I think he is the best that ever lived. I don't even think there's any argument. So thank you to him for coming on the show. Absolutely. Just, I really love this holiday special, and I really appreciate all the folks who have made this a part of their holiday traditions. and it really means a lot to me. So I hope everybody out there has a awesome, fantastic holiday season, and you'll be hearing from me in a couple of weeks with Gentleman Greg Bishop for the year in review. Thank you, everybody. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Happy holidays.